Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Anne Lamott's new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love, is her 20th book and published on her 70th birthday. In the new book, she explores love and the power it has on our lives. In each chapter, Lamott refracts all the colors of the spectrum. She explores the unexpected love for a partner later in life, the bruised and bruising love for a child who disappoints, even frightens, the sustaining love among a group of sinners, for a community in transition in the wider world. The lessons she underscores are that love enlightens as it educates, comforts as it energizes, sustains as it surprises. Anne Lamott is the author of 20 books, including the New York Times bestsellers Help, Thanks, Wow, Dusk, Night, Dawn, Traveling Mercies, and Bird by Bird, as well as 7 novels. Her latest is Somehow, Thoughts on Love. It's an absolute delight to welcome Anne Lamott to this week's book show. How are you?
Thank you, Joe. I'm just fine.
It's always a treat for me to talk to you. I have such respect for you and for your work. It is your birthday today as we record this, so I wish you a very happy birthday. And is launching a book on your birthday, is that fun? Is that a good way to celebrate?
It's not ideal because the perfect day for me is at home with my animals on the couch and possibly the new New Yorker. But I find travel and self-promotion a little iffy, let's say. But you have been great. And I really loved our first interview. And I'm really happy I get to talk to you on my birthday.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor. I have to say that this book is so beautiful, and it reminded me once again of what just an outstanding writer you are and how potent your words are and the language and the examples that you give. And to take a concept as known as love and explore it seems like a huge task. And I'm wondering how you put your mind around that to be able to corral it.
Well, that's a great question. But, you know, in Bird by Bird, I talk about taking things just bird by bird, one aspect of them at a time. And so I didn't start out thinking I was writing a book on love. I started out wanting to write some pieces that would be kind of an owner's manual for my son and grandson when I'm gone, that covered everything that has ever worked before in my life during hard or scary times, that will almost certainly work for them no matter what their future brings. And little by little, I discovered that everything that I was writing about ultimately had to do with love. So it was definitely kind of a surprise to me. I mean, my husband, I told you, I think, wrote a book on the inner critic called Better Days and on quieting the inner critic. And from my first hours with this book, my inner critic was saying, there is no word more overused, no thought, no anything more overused. Don't do it, Annie. Don't do it. You can't write a book on love. What do you know? You're a broken down old alcoholic. I'm sober 37 years, but still my inner critic immediately goes there. And so I keep mentioning it. It was kind of accidental that it was a book on love, because really it was kind of more an operating instructions for my son and grandchild.
You write in the book about 2/3 of the way through, love among others is the ocean with tides, krill, and weird, beautiful fish, and love is a pond or a pool where we teach little kids to swim, first showing them that something holds them up in the water, then how to blow bubbles on the surface, and then how to blow bubbles underwater so they can always find their way back up. What a gorgeous way of describing love.
Well, thank you. I knew that. I'd heard that. Maybe my dad told me when I was young that if you ever get tossed about in the surf and you get disoriented and it's dark and scary, you don't know where you are, where the surface is, you blow bubbles and follow them because they rise to the surface. And I thought, just such a beautiful metaphor for finding our way again and knowing that love has taught us over time that there are people waiting for us at the surface, splashing around, trying to help us find our way.
You write quite a bit about your father in this book.
Well, I did. I wrote a whole book about him. My first novel was called Hard Laughter, and it was about his diagnosis with a terminal kind of brain cancer. But in the book, because it was fiction, I made it seem like he might make it out, but he wasn't going to. And yeah, he just 2 days ago would have been 101, but I got a bad deal and I lost him when I was 25, and that has been a ongoing source of loss and grief that other people got to have their dads up until the dads were 80 and 90. And but anyway, I felt him a number of times in various of essays in the new book. And yeah, because I write about death, I think a lot of people are uncomfortable about it, but the reason they're uncomfortable about it is because they're not reading about it enough or being with people who are dying enough, which is the main way to get unafraid of being afraid of death. And so I told a couple stories in it that do have to do with people at the very end of their life and how really beautiful and peaceful and surprisingly easy it is for people to cross over to whatever awaits us.
There's a section in the book in writing about your father entering into it about the boxes that we have and the memories and going through boxes of your father's effects. You say so much of his childhood art is in these boxes. Maybe he'll have a show someday. And every school picture from preschool, why there's that little Christian girl who sank her front teeth into Sam's forehead. That's what love looks like at 3 years old. I wonder how she's turned out. Probably MAGA. That's a great thing for you. And this is you moving from one place to another and looking at these artifacts.
That's a piece on attics. I forgot what it, oh, it's called Up Above, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's about moving boxes from one residence to the other, some of which you didn't open from the time that you moved into that residence before you moved into the new residence. So it's like, what mattered to us? What really got in deep every step of the way that felt meaningful and worthy of holding on to? What mementos, what souvenirs, what moments in history, what photos? And you could tell somebody's whole story by just going through the papers in their box one by one.
My basement is filled with boxes from that of my mother and father and my wife's father and other people who are special to us, and we have kept this. You go through those boxes and it's very hard. And a lot of people say, well, why don't you just throw it out? And but you learn so much in the process. And I love the way you write about it because there are a lot of things that you throw out, but there's also the things that you identify as being important and special, and things that you need to hold on to. And I'm interested in how you came to that. I guess it's ultimately what speaks to you, right?
It does. It's like if you pick up a piece of your child's artwork or your own child, your own artwork, or I found some papers that my younger brother, who's 5 years younger, wrote in like second grade, and his handwriting in second grade is as familiar as my own, because I love him so, so, so much, and I love him to this day, just more than I can express. And so I would see this paper he wrote about fish and the drawings, because in second grade, you still get to illustrate your writing, which you don't get to do at 70. But it just was so touching to me and to remember being there, probably helping him with his paper and the family being so delighted with his work. Whereas a lot of the time, because my parents weren't happy together, there was not all that much delight going on, So you save stuff that moved you then, that moves you all over again. And no one is in charge of what you throw out or keep. They're your boxes.
And it doesn't matter. It's what matters to you.
It's what matters to you. It's what stirred you. It's what moves you still. It's what brings you flickers of beautiful memories or stuff you're just so glad happened and to be reminded of on any given day. It can change your whole day around to find a photo from 50 years ago of a birthday you forgot or a moment at the beach where you just felt fully alive.
Anne Lamott is our guest on this week's book show. The new book is Somehow, Thoughts on Love. It is published by Riverhead. You do write about your childhood. You mentioned that your parents were unhappy with one another. You seem to tell us in this book that you were worried about something. You were always concerned about something. You were always trying to figure out what the right thing to do was. And do you still have elements of that very much a
Of that
part of
worry
you?
and anxiety. Partly I just came this way. I think I was very high strung and very sensitive, and I took everything, and I still take everything personally. I think my nerves were really damaged by being in a family that was just so competitive and unhappy and straight-laced and whatnot. And yeah, I have a pretty impressive anxiety disorder for which I've gotten a lot of help and continue to get a lot of help. But this side of the grave, I'm just going to be a lot more anxious than the average bear. My faith has also increased and my self-love has also increased. So those are two things that really affect how, whether or not the anxiety gets its way with me, because one of the blessings of being older is that you notice sooner and sooner, like within the hour, that you're really off track and that you have ways to get back on track. Whereas when I was younger, it might be weeks where something was just pestering me or vexing me or, you know, keeping me just uptight. And now I'm 70, and but probably somewhere in my mid 50s and definitely by 60, I started being aware of it sooner and sooner and just bringing out one of the tools from the battered old toolbox and finding my way back to the present moment and noticing that everything was pretty much more or less okay.
Is writing part of the toolbox?
No, not for me. Writing is partly what creates the anxiety. Yeah.
But it seems like it helps center you. I guess, so the way of asking that question, the perhaps easiest way for me to ask that question is that it's not that you're working things out through the writing. You've already worked them out and you are explaining it to us.
Exactly. I think writing is hard. It's hard for everyone I know. Except for Neil, because he was trained as a journalist for his first 10 years. And so he knows he has to do it shorter rather than longer, and he needs to get it done. And then I don't have that kind of discipline and training. And so I do what I've always talked about in Bird by Bird. It takes me forever and I write too long and I have to go back and I have to do multiple drafts and whatnot. So I wouldn't say the writing helps diminish the anxiety, except in the long game. Because what I do is I try to capture what I think is true about life, how to live this one human life, even as I face my own mortality and the mortality of everyone I love. How do we live in the face of that? And because I've written about it so much, I think I have some knowledge, a few old truths that serve me, that i.e., that the perfectionism I was raised to adopt hurt me then and hurts me now, that no one's perfect, nothing's perfect, and the perfectionism is the voice of the oppressor, as I said in Bird by Bird, the voice of the enemy. And so when it's here, I have these tools to say, uh-oh, it's here, the perfectionism. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to take too long. It's okay to kind of veer all over the place until you find what you were after all along. So the long game with writing has given me a lot of experiences that often through pain taught me more about life and how to live.
Let me just touch on that of pain, but you write an essay in this book about a retweet that really blew up and became sort of looked at you in a way that ultimately some found transphobic. And there was a process of trying to cancel you. You write in the book about how painful that was and all of the things that you did. But what struck me the most was at one point where you were invited to be a part of something after you had already lived through this. And then you were questioned as to whether you should be a part of it because of they just found out about this thing. Yeah. You sent them all the stuff that you wrote and said, okay, find it in here. It was so striking to me. It's, yes, there was this one thing that I retweeted, but here is my body of work.
Right.
You tell me.
Look around, fish around, and find a word where I am transphobic, homophobic, racist, sexist, ageist. It's like I screwed up. And when I screw up, it often goes viral. And yet it's not who I am. And look around and come get back to me on this, you know? And I thought, because I wrote a piece that I love in some other book filled with contrition and everything I could do to try to make it right. But you know what? And I thought I'd put that dog to bed, but nope, the dog was just pretending to be asleep, and it rose back up. You know, people said, "This is who you are." And I had to address it again just last year. And so I wrote about it because the message to me was the message of the culture, beginning with early childhood, which is that you're not good, you're not okay, you're secretly a fraud, you're secretly a disgusting person. Do better, work harder, keep your weight down, achieve more, you know, all of it. And the message was a lie. It was the great palace lie. And the truth is that you get to make mistakes, you get to clean them up, and you get to get on with your life.
It also is a wonderful lesson about looking at the totality of someone's life. I mean, obviously, you have a body of work to show people, and I guess we all do in some respect, of what we can represent, who we really are if we screw up.
Yeah, so much of my energy and time as a child and a grown-up went into appearing to be like really, you know, highly accomplished and charming and good-hearted. And but it's like curating your life for Facebook, you know, and presenting stuff that will present the ideal image of yourself. It's a presentation. I got sober almost 38 years ago, and I started learning then that everybody was just like me on the inside. They were sort of screwed up. Their secret lives were judgmental or petty or materialistic, and that it was part of the human condition. It was part of how we stayed safe, was to work on appearing to be so just such fine people, but that the people that you draw close to, the closest people in your life, who will always be there for you through thick and thin, completely identify with all your secrets, all the dark corners of who you are, all your screw ups, all your best efforts to fake people out, and all the truth of who you really are way down deep in our most authentic selves. And that's who we're here to reclaim.
You write that your father, almost in passing, you write that your father was an atheist, which I found interesting given your strong connection to Christianity and to spirituality. And how did that assist you in coming to how you write about these topics and how you really get through life?
On the one hand, I always had a lot of shame of being a secret believer because both my parents were just so such overeducated intellectuals, and I had this secret belief in something that they just thought was insane and actually stupid. And so I had the shame on the one hand. On the other, I didn't have any dogma or doctrine that I was expected to believe in except atheism. And so I got to really study what came to me. I got to study what was foisted at me on me by people I really loved and respected who had a faith in God or faith in the great universal spirit, Gus, who had a faith in good orderly direction, which spells God. I loved and studied the Buddhists and Hindus and Catholics, and I studied the poets. You know, if you want to find out about God and spirit, read the poets. So read Yeats to begin with, read John O'Donohue. And so I had that freedom to come up with my own sense of God, God as I understood God, and not anything that was rammed down my throat. And a lot of people that like my work or come to my readings or whatever are people who had it all rammed down their throats and spent years just running from it and thinking they were never going to find a path to any kind of connection at all with something bigger than our own sort of rattled or anxious minds. And so my parents' atheism gave me both that anxiety that I believed something stupid, i.e., that there was a power greater than me, and that there was some sort of love energy surrounding me that created me, that indwelled me, that guided me, that just thought I was fine and I really didn't need to do better in school. I mean, I might every so often have brought home a B plus, and as a child, and when I did, I had to have these conferences with my dad, you know, to see if there was time to raise it. So, but I came up with this understanding of a higher being, a presence of love that wasn't grading me, you know, that just thought I was, you know, sort of fabulous and maybe kind of hilarious as is.
Anne Lamott is our guest in this week's book show. The new book is Somehow and published by Riverhead. You have taught Sunday school for over 30 years. And how do you work with your students? You write about a lot of the interactions that you have with these children that you're not ramming it down their throat.
No. The culture and the world and their parents are ramming it down their throat. I have kids who are going through just god-awful divorces and being eaten alive by their parents' hostility and need for revenge. And you know what that's like. You've seen it. It just destroys little beings. And then I have a lot of children who are brown or black, and they're getting it at school, and they're getting it from the culture that they're less than, or that they need to do supremely extra, double, 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 extra better to make up for the fact that the culture sees them as slightly lesser or a source of threat. And so I just try to be the counterweight to that you are beautiful and you are safe. You are cherished. You are safe. We are always here for you and we are listening to you. And you don't need to keep secrets that what you are fearing the most is stuff that you get to talk about with people that are safe. And we are as sick as our secrets. And you don't need to have them because you are so beautiful to me and to God. And perfect as is. So, yeah, let's have a snack and let's get the art supplies out now.
And nature and taking a
And
walk.
nature and taking a walk. My husband says in his book, Better Days, and then of course I stole it because writers are parrots and thieves, that everything that is beautiful and true about life can be discovered on any 10-minute walk. And you get yourself outside, you get away from the email and you get away from the text and you get away from the social media and you step outside and you look up. You look around, you wave to your neighbors, you rejoice in seeing your 93-year-old neighbor Jesse still taking his daily walk, still stopping to say hello. And you look around and you look at the daffodils that are springing up everywhere right now. You look at the spring, you look at the resurrection of the earth from cold and freezing and dark and the rocky, cold, hard earth that is now bursting with wildflowers and grass. It's a reset button.
This is a tiny thing, but it struck me. It's almost stopped me cold when I was reading it because I was so struck by it. But you write early in the book about you're referencing a child, and you said, "My friend." And I just thought that was beautiful because we don't often think of children that are a part of our lives as friends. And that's a beautiful way to think of it, and in such a simple way to think of it.
They're very, very short friends who make messes. And it's good to always have Kleenex when you're around these short friends. But, and children can be beasts. I don't have any illusions that they're angels. They can be beasts on the blacktop. But they come here so sweet and generous. You know, I make my grandchild and before him, my son, school lunches, and they give them away to some kid who forgot his. You know, they give away everything you don't want them to give away because they come here as little beings of wonder and generosity. My husband says in his book that curiosity is a synonym for love. And they come here with that, embodying that, with that curiosity and that wonder and that love and that generosity, amongst other qualities. You know, in my wisdom tradition, we are taught that you must start to be a lot more like that to enter into the kingdom, which is gratitude and curiosity and faith that, like, I'm mostly quoting from Neil's book now, but that life tilts towards the good. And so I love what my kids have taught me. I mean, and they're so funny, they make me laugh.
Animals too are a part.
Well, I've always said that the closest we come to feeling the direct love of God is from our animals. And I still believe that to be true.
The first part of the book is a chapter called Swag, and it's fascinating because again you talk about friends and people who live on the street and are people that you meet in a park and sitting down on a bench with them and offering them items and sort of realizing how ridiculous some of it is of giving floss to someone who doesn't have a home or you know can't brush their teeth or whatever the case may be. But it's an empathy and it's also an understanding that there's what you want out of that and how they react and coming to terms with that reaction that is really fascinating.
Oh, thank you. Well, I really love that piece. I do have one friend who lives on the street, and I do have a church, a very progressive church that spends a lot of energy and money and time ministering to them, making sure they have water and food. And they were giving out these bags, these swag bags of bath products and dental products, and but hats and socks also very practical. And so I set about getting distributing my these bags. I called them the purple bags of love to some street people, only one of whom I knew well. You think you know what you're up to and who you are compared to who they are, and you really learn over and over again, there's just one of us.
When you are out and you're talking to people, and there is a group there that so respects you and your work, do you think about what you provide people, of how you help people?
I don't think about it so much, but I do try to offer whatever wisdom I've gleaned along the way. And I just from an early age, partly because my dad was a writer, and partly because I really found spiritual and religious salvation in the written book in chapter books as a little girl. I just try to provide on the page stories in which people can get lost, and then hopefully one hopes find themselves, because that was always how I found myself, was by getting lost in wonderful writing. And so I don't think about, oh, I hope this will really change people's life or help them wake up or, hit the reset button. But I mean, I'm thrilled when it does. But what I mostly think about is, I love this story. I'll tell it to Neil or tell it to my son or a girlfriend, and they'll love that story too. And then I might feel emboldened to put it down on paper.
The name of the new book is Somehow, Thoughts on Love. It is published by Riverhead. Anne Lamott, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. I've enjoyed our conversation so much over the years, and it's always a highlight when I get to speak to you again. I wish you a very, very happy birthday and a beautiful year to come. Thank you so much for
Thank you, Joe.
being
I
with
just
us.
want to say these two interviews you've done with me for this book, for Somehow, have been my two favorite interviews of all. I can't wait to talk to you again someday.
Again, the name of Anne Lamott's new book is Somehow, Thoughts on Love. It is published by Riverhead. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.